So take a few minutes to make sure that your motivation for being here, listening to this talk, is one that incorporates not only your own benefit, but the benefit of others, all living beings if possible. The altruistic wish to benefit all beings and, if possible, to become fully enlightened, a Buddha, to help them in the best possible way. So, good evening. I'm here again. Yeah, so 2 days ago, Venerable Chudrin said she's just got so much to do and asked if I could give the talk tonight. And I was happy because I had had the thought when I was giving the other talks on the seven types of awareness that it would be helpful to talk about the topic of mental factors. So this gives me a chance to introduce that. I mean, we certainly can't cover everything. It's very vast, but we can start. Now, maybe other opportunities when Venerable Chudrin is away or busy, we can continue. Okay, so I'm sure some of you have studied this before. It's not unfamiliar to you, but probably some of you haven't. And even if you have, it doesn't hurt to go through it again. And I'm happy to do it too, because I've actually never really taught this topic. I've taught other aspects of the mind, of Lowrig, but not the mental factors. So it's helpful for me to get more familiar with it. So I made this hand, this file that I hope everyone has, either in your lap, on your device or printout. Okay, so previously, with the other series of talks, we started off looking at mind or awareness, low, and there's many different words for mind in Buddhism. But what we're talking about is something that's clear and knowing. That's the actual definition of the mind. That which is clear and knowing, and mind isn't just one thing sitting inside of us like a machine that's thinking and feeling and having all these different experiences, but rather it's a stream. They actually use the term in Tibetan of mind stream or mental continuum. It's a stream made up of individual mental events, individual moments of mind, individual experiences. So it's constantly changing every minute, every second, every nanosecond. And each mental state, each mental event lasts only a very short period of time. It arises and immediately disappears, and the next one immediately arises and disappears, and the next one arises and disappears, and so on. So the mind is just this ever-flowing and ever-changing stream of individual experiences, individual states of mind or mental events. Okay, so it's important. It's hard to understand that, but that's that's how it is. So we have to get used to that idea. So it's like I said previously. It's probably better to talk about minds in the plural rather than mind in the singular. Because if we just say mind, then we can get this idea of it's just this one thing. But it is plural. It's a plurality rather than a single thing. And every moment of mind, every single experience has these qualities of being clear and knowing. Clear, the easiest way of understanding that is non-material, non-physical. So it doesn't have any physical properties like shape, color, size, weight, dimension. It's not visible to our eyes or tangible to our touch. So it's totally non-material, non-physical. And then knowing, the other word is experiencing. That's what mind does. It experiences, it knows, it is aware. So it's that part of us that has experiences or is experiences. It is experiencing things constantly, every minute, every second. And then there's different ways we can divide up mind or minds, awarenesses. So one way is what we looked at previously, the seven kinds of awareness. So that's one way of dividing up mind. And what I've heard and what I've read is that for the most part, every single experience that we have will fit into one of those seven, is one of those seven. There seems to be some discussion about possible exceptions that don't quite fit into any of those. But it seems that most, the vast majority of our experiences will be one of those seven types of awareness. So it's useful to know about those seven and try to identify them, try to recognize them in ourself. So that's one way we can divide up mind or awarenesses. And another way we can divide up minds or awarenesses is into these two things we're talking about here. Minds or main minds and mental factors. So sometimes they just say minds, but it's, yeah, also main minds or primary minds. Some translators use the term primary minds. And mental factors. So what is the difference between them? So a main mind, chosem in Tibetan, is an awareness that knows the mere entity or mere presence of an object. So that's its function. It just knows the presence of an object without going into details about it or reacting to it or analyzing it or anything like that. It's just aware of the object being there. And then mental factors, there's many, many different mental factors. So they have different jobs. Each mental factor has its own kind of job or its own kind of way of dealing with objects. So they are said to apprehend various features of the object, and they also affect the way the mind apprehends the object. Okay, so this will probably become more clear as we go along and look at different types of main minds and mental factors and how they work together. But anyway, this is just a general explanation of these two, and each of these main minds and mental factors have these qualities of being clear and knowing. Okay, so that's the stuff that they're made of, you could say. It's not really stuff, it's not physical stuff, but that's their nature is to be clear and knowing, they're like mutually exclusive, okay? So a main mind is never a mental factor, and a mental factor is never a main mind. However, they always work together. So if we look at the paragraph underneath that, it says minds. So sometimes I'm going to just say minds rather than main minds, because they do that in the text. Minds and mental factors always work together, never separately. A main mind can never exist by itself without mental factors accompanying it, And a mental factor can never exist by itself without accompanying a main mind. I had this image of little children, you know, little children can never go walking in the city by themselves. They always have to be with their parent. So they always have to be together, main minds and mental factors. They can never operate separately or exist separately. They always come together in a group, in a package. Okay, here's an example. For example, when we look at a flower, we're starting to see flowers now, lots of daffodils down in the garden, really pretty. So if we're looking at a flower, there is an eye consciousness, okay, there's a visual consciousness, and that's a main mind. And together with it, as if in the same package, there are a number of mental factors. There's always at least five mental factors. Never less than five. There could be more than five, but there's always at least five mental factors. We'll look at that later, which five they are. Okay, so this eye consciousness that's looking at the flower consists of, it's like if we dissect that experience, okay, that experience of looking at the flower, if we dissect it, break it into its parts, it consists of one main mind, which is an eye consciousness, and then a number of mental factors that are all together, lumped together. So I made this little this little design down below just to kind of give you some idea. Yeah. But don't take this too literally, because remember, mind and mental factors don't have shape, don't have color, don't have any physical properties. So we can't sort of wonder, well, how do they actually fit together? Are the mental factors inside of the main mind or outside of it or overlapping it like here? So don't worry, don't think like that, because it's not really possible to understand that, because they're not physical things. But they're all somehow together, you know, working together and not separately. Okay, so that the main mind, the eye consciousness, looking at the flower, just knows the entity of the object, the flower. Just knows that there's the flower there, the object there. And then the mental factors engage with the object in different ways. So one of the most famous mental factors, probably the most famous mental factor, is feeling. It's also one of the five aggregates, okay? So feeling is also one of the ever-present mental factors. So it's always there with every single main mind. So what feeling will do is experiencing the object as either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So when we look at a pretty yellow flower or whatever, we probably have a pleasant feeling. I mean, some people may not. They may have an unpleasant feeling, but I think generally people like flowers. That's why we give them as gifts and we put them on the altar, and, you know, they're beautiful and they bring kind of joy. But there may be people who don't like flowers, so they have an unpleasant feeling. So anyway, whatever kind of feeling you have when looking at the flower, there's always one of those three, a pleasant or an unpleasant or neutral. Okay, that's another possibility, just neither pleasant nor unpleasant, just kind of blah. Okay, so that feeling that we have, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, that is a mental factor that is accompanying together with, in the same package as the eye consciousness. And another famous mental factor is discrimination, which is also one of the aggregates, the third aggregate. And that has the function of distinguishing the object. So when we look at a flower, discrimination is able to know that it's a flower and not a rock. And also the details, you know, the color of it and shape and so on. This isn't necessarily conceptual, because with an eye consciousness, when we're just looking with eye consciousness, that's not a conceptual mind. So that's not thinking that is a flower, that is a daffodil, that is yellow. It's not that. But discrimination simply is able to distinguish features of the object that make it different from other objects. And then later, the conceptual mind will start giving names like, oh, what a pretty daffodil, it's yellow, or it's white, or whatever. Names, labels, okay? But even before that, just the eye consciousness itself is able to distinguish certain features of that object to be able to differentiate it from other objects. And that's the function of discrimination. And then there may be attachment present. Yeah, we might think, oh, this flower is so wonderful. I want to own it. I want to possess it. I want to take it and bring it home and put it in my room or give it to my friend or whatever. So wanting it, you know, grasping at it, wanting it. Okay. Although now that I'm thinking about it, attachment, this is a difference in we'll look at this later, but in some schools they may say attachment can accompany sense consciousness, but other schools would say no. So there's different opinions about that. I think in our tradition, the Suttantrika tradition, they would say no. So I made a boo-boo there. But it could occur together with a concept, the conceptual mind. If after looking at the flower, we start thinking about it, oh, it's so pretty, it's so nice, wouldn't it be nice if it was in my room? So that would be attachment together with the conceptual mind, but it probably wouldn't accompany the eye consciousness. That makes sense. You look puzzled.
If attachment were to accompany a visual consciousness or any of the five sense consciousnesses, it would necessarily be non-conceptual attachment.
Yeah, it would be non-conceptual. This is actually only in the Abhidharma Kosha by Vasubandhu, which is the Vibhashika school. So in that text, he says that it's possible to have like a delusion, or what we call afflictive emotions, like attachment and anger and so on, together with sense consciousnesses. So yeah, they would be non-conceptual. But that, when I came across that, I was quite surprised, because other, like normally when we study low reiki, it's according to the Suttantrika school, and they wouldn't say that. So we can put that aside. So yeah.
The aspect of wanting to possess it sounds a lot like craving for it. Mm-hmm. How are those two different?
Well, I don't know. There are so many different terms. Again, you know, there's craving, there's attachment, there's clinging, there's desire. But within the mental factors, I don't think there is a mental factor called craving. I think it's attachment. But then craving comes into the 12 links, 12 links of dependent origination, and they do say it's a kind of attachment. Yeah. So I guess there could be different kinds of attachment. Yeah. I don't know everything, okay? So don't expect me to be able to answer all these questions. Still a lot of things that aren't clear to me. Okay, so that's just a kind of general explanation of minds and mental factors. And then this little drawing says, each mental event, each moment, each experience that we have consists of one main mind and then a number of mental factors. The minimum is five. And then the next paragraph says, several analogies are used to help us understand the relationship between main minds and the mental factors that accompany them. One analogy is that the main mind is like the main part of a hand. I don't know what we call this part. Oh. That's only this side, but there's also the back side. So I don't know what, if there's an official name for this. Anyway, this part of the hand, front and back, palm and back, that's like the main mind, and then the mental factors are like fingers, okay? So they're all together. They're all, you know, kind of one thing. And they have different functions too, because the fingers have different functions. One is for pointing, one is for wearing a wedding ring, one is for, I don't know, different things. In fact, I don't know if it's even proper to call this a finger, right? We do say five fingers, huh? But then each one also has its own name. Okay, anyway, another analogy is the main mind is like a president, and the mental factors are like his or her ministers or secretaries, each with their own portfolio. Okay, so when you have the person in charge, and then that person will have different, I don't know, they call them secretaries, right? Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of the, whatever, Defense. I think in England it's ministers. Yeah, anyway. So they all this group of people work together to run the country, okay? One person can't manage everything on their own. So each person has their own job. But the president or prime minister is the head of all of them, kind of keeps them all together. So that might help. But don't take any of these analogies too literally. It's just to help us understand. And next it says, the term retinue is sometimes used for the mental factors that accompany a main mind. For example, they'll say the feeling that is in the retinue of that consciousness. But I'm not sure if that's really a Tibetan term translated as retinue or if it's just an analogy. So I'm not sure if that's an official term, but it is used sometimes. So they use that term retinue to refer to a mental factor that is accompanying a main mind. And another term they use is concomitant or having similarity. And this is definitely a Tibetan term. Sungden. So they will say, for example, this is more like in the philosophical text, you'll come across this term, the feeling concomitant with or having similarity with that consciousness. Okay, so this is terminology used to describe a mental factor that is together with, attached to, but part of that package with a particular main mind. That makes sense? And then, so this is important, this next thing coming up. A main mind and the mental factors accompanying it, together with it in the same package, are said to be of one nature, one entity. So this expression, one nature, one entity, it doesn't mean they are one and the same. They're just one thing. But what it means is, if things are of one nature, one entity, they arise together, they arise simultaneously, and they also cease simultaneously. So it's like they're together, they're simultaneous and together and inseparable. They're also inseparable. You can't separate them. It's a concept that often comes up in the teachings. For example, in the teachings on emptiness or the two truths, they say that the two truths of an object are one nature. You've probably heard that before, right? The conventional truth and the ultimate truth of an object, like this book. Okay, so this book has both truths, two truths. Conventional truth and ultimate truth. Conventional truth is, how it exists conventionally, made of paper and ink and glue and so forth, and labeled book. Okay, so all the conventional aspects of the book, that's the conventional truth. Then the ultimate truth of the book is its emptiness, empty of inherent existence. So those two things, the conventional truth of the book and the ultimate truth of the book, are said to be one nature, one entity. It doesn't mean they are the same thing. They are different because we need different minds to be able to know the conventional and the ultimate. One mind cannot know both. But they can't be separated. We can't put the book in one place and have the emptiness of the book somewhere else. That's impossible. So they're always together, like in one package, inseparably, and yet they're different things. Does that make sense? Another example of things that are one nature, one entity, is an object and its parts. For example, our body. We each have a body, and our body is made up of many, many parts, arms and legs and bones and blood and eyes and nose and cells, the billions of different parts. So our body and the parts of our body are one nature. We can't separate them. We can't have our body in one place and the parts of the body in another place. Does that make sense? Okay, so wherever our body is, the parts of our body are there too. They're inseparable, even though they're not exactly the same thing. So those are some examples of things that have one nature or one entity. So that applies to a main mind and the mental factors accompanying it. Not all main minds, not all mental factors, but that particular package that consists of a single main mind and the mental factors that are accompanying it. Those are of one nature, one entity. They can't be separated. And they have what are called five similarities, five things they share. The first is basis or support. And this refers to the, in technical terms, the uncommon empowering condition, which we looked at previously when we were looking at direct perceptions. And it refers to the sense power. Okay, so whatever mind, whatever moment of mind, mental event arises, it arises in dependence on a sense power. An eye consciousness arises in dependence on the eye sense power, which is some kind of subtle matter inside our eyeball. When we hear a sound, ear consciousness arises in dependence on the ear sense power, and so on. So there's five physical sense powers related to our five physical senses, seeing, hearing, smell, taste, and touch. And then the mental sense power. Do you remember what that was? What's the mental sense power? Yeah, previous moment of mind, whatever mind it was. It could be an eye consciousness or an ear consciousness or a mental consciousness. So any of the six types of minds, whatever was just prior to that, just before that, that's the mental sense power. Okay, so that's one of the three important conditions that needs to be present for a mind to arise. Okay, so a moment of mind, which consists of a main mind and all its mental factors, they all arise from the same sense power. So the eye consciousness, for example, I was talking about looking at a flower, seeing a flower. So the eye consciousness seeing the flower and the mental factors accompanying it, the feeling, discrimination, and so on. So they all arise in dependence on the same sense power, the eye sense power. Number two, object of observation, they observe the same object. So it's not the case that the main mind is looking at the flower and the feeling is looking at something else over there. So they're all focusing on or observing the same object. They have the same object. And the third is aspect, which is a little hard to understand, but they say that whenever we have any experience, any mental experience, the mind actually arises in the aspect of the object that we're looking at or experiencing. Similar to a reflection in a mirror. They say our mind is a little bit like a reflection in a mirror. When you put an object in front of a mirror, then it casts an image of itself into the mirror, and the mirror takes on a reflection of that object. So they say in a similar way, our mind arises like a reflection in a mirror, reflecting the object that is appearing to it. The main mind and all the mental factors accompanying it all take on the same aspect or arise in the same aspect of whatever the object is. So it's like if it's blue, the color blue, we're looking at blue. So the main mind and all the mental factors with it take on this aspect of blue. That's what they say. I've always had that little bit of difficulty understanding that, but this takes time to think about it and get used to it. Number four, time. This is easier. So the main mind and the mental factors in its retinue all arise simultaneously, abide, they only abide for a moment, and then cease simultaneously. Okay? So they're totally simultaneous. And then number five is called substance or substantial entity. This is another one that's always been a little tricky to understand. And I came across a few different ways of explaining it in Geshe Rapton's book. This is a really excellent book if you want to know more about mental factors, because some books, like the one by Lhati Rinpoche and Elizabeth Knapper, Mind and Tibetan Buddhism, it doesn't have much about the mental factors, very, very little. Basically, just lists, but not much explanation. This book has a lot of explanation, so it sort of brings them alive. So in here, he says, the meaning of this fifth one, substance, is that their cognitive nature is always the same. For example, mistaken or unmistaken, conceptual or non-conceptual. Okay, so if the main mind is mistaken, then the mental factors accompanying it will also be mistaken. And the same if unmistaken, conceptual or non-conceptual. So they're always, you know, the same type of mind. So that's one way of explaining that. Another way is there's this text. I'm happy to send it to anyone who wants. It's a text by an author named Yeshe Gelson. It has a very long title. I'm just trying to find the title here. A necklace? Huh? Where'd you find it? Yeah, because it's not published. Actually, Herbert Günther, I don't know if anyone's ever read any of his books. He was someone who translated quite a few texts in the past. So he actually did a translation of this text, but his way of translating is very difficult. The terms he uses is very difficult to understand what he's talking about. So so this translation is a retranslation and using the kind of the terminology we're used to, like Jeffrey and Elizabeth and so on. Yeah, so anyway, the title of this text is A Necklace for Those of Clear Awareness, Clearly Revealing the Modes of Minds and Mental Factors. And translated by Tosugi. So it's a nice text. So I can send that to anyone who's interested. But anyway, so in that text, he says the meaning of this fifth point is that in the retinue of a main mind, there can only be one mental factor of each type. There can only be one feeling, one discrimination, one. You can't have more than one of each type. And that's also explained. It's a problem? Oh, well. Yeah, but I guess Geshe Rapton agrees with this too. I mean, there's nobody who disagrees with this. Nobody who says you can have two feelings at the same time. No. Yeah. Well, I think sometimes Geshe Rapton's trying to make things simple, you know, not too complicated. But it could also be his text is based on Pubujok, another author, so the different authors can explain things differently. So anyway, these five things can give you some understanding of the relationship between the mind and the mental factors accompanying it. And but it does help to know this, because sometimes you might get into a situation where you could think that, oh, there could be two feelings together at the same moment with the same mind. But that's actually not possible.
Between the two sets of the five similarities posited by Vasubandhu and Asanga, is there a more commonly accepted version between the one in the Abhidharmakosha and the Abhidharmasamachaya?
This one?
Okay.
Well, I mean, in the monasteries, my understanding is in the Tibetan monasteries, although they do study the Abhidharmakosha, they study that kind of later on. But when the monks are young, starting out their studies, and they study Lorig to know about the mind and all the different types of mind, they study it according to the Saptantika school. So that seems to be the version that's more commonly accepted. Not to say that it's right or wrong, but yeah, because in Vasubandhu's Abhidharmakosha, he has a somewhat different list of the five similarities. But mostly I think it's the same.
Fifth one is quite different.
Let me just look.
Instead of substance and substance or substantial entity, it's similar realm and level.
Similar what?
Realm and level.
Yeah, but I think the other school would agree with that as well. Because, like, for example, desire realm, they talk about desire realm minds and first concentration minds and formless minds and so on. So there are, differences in that point of view. So you couldn't have a main mind that belongs to the desire realm and a feeling that belongs to the form realm together at the same time. That wouldn't make sense. So I don't know how these differences come about. But, you know, they were two brothers, Asanga and Vasubandhu. They were brothers. So, you know, brothers have differences. But I don't know if that's the reason or whatever, how these things come about. But yeah, Vasubandhu's explanation of the minds and mental factors does have quite a few differences, which we'll look at a little bit later. But I don't think they're really contradictory. I mean, even within Satrantika, you know, like Purbujok's text and another text, the one that was translated into Tibetan Buddhism, Geshe Jumbel Sambel, I think his name was. So there were differences between those two, even though, you know, they're both Tibetans and they're, you know, Galupas, and they're talking about the same subject, but, you know, there can be differences. This happens. Anyway, I think this list is quite helpful, quite the normal way of explaining the similarities, how minds and their mental factors relate to each other and are similar to each other. Okay, next it says, the mental factors can color or flavor the mind. But again, don't take that too literally, because, you know, they don't really have colors or flavors, but just how they can affect the mind. For example, if a virtuous mental factor, such as faith, is present, the main mind and the other mental factors accompanying it all become virtuous. So the whole mind becomes virtuous. That whole package becomes virtuous. Likewise, if a non-virtuous mental factor, such as anger, is present, then the main mind and the other mental factors concomitant with it become non-virtuous. That whole state of mind becomes non-virtuous. So you couldn't have a non-virtuous mental factor and a virtuous mental factor at the same time, or a non-virtuous mental factor and a virtuous main mind. That would be impossible. So they're either totally non-virtuous or totally virtuous, or neutral. It could also be neutral. But it's the mental factors that cause that, not the main mind itself. The main mind itself is just kind of neutral. But it depends on what mental factors are present that make it virtuous or non-virtuous. So mental factors are really important. And then it says, and such states of mind in turn influence our actions. So in Geshe Rabten's book, he says, it is the mental factors that are primarily responsible for leading us to all forms of experience. When the mind is under the influence of unwholesome mental factors, such as attachment and anger, one is led into committing actions that cause experiences of frustration and suffering. But whenever the mind is dominated by wholesome factors, such as compassion and patience, then any ensuing physical and vocal activity will only result in happiness and well-being. So mental factors are very, very, very important. They determine whether our mind is virtuous or non-virtuous, and the actions that we do, then whether they become virtuous or non-virtuous. It really depends on the mental factors. So we really need to try to make sure we have the virtuous ones as much as possible and reduce and eliminate the non-virtuous as much as possible. Okay, so now let's look at some divisions. Start with the main minds, because that's easier. Not so many divisions. So main minds, or primary minds, as they're sometimes called. So they can be divided into two. A simple way of dividing them is into sensory and mental, according to whether they arise in dependence on a physical sense power, like the eye sense power, and so on, or the mental sense power, the previous moment of mind. Okay, so main minds can be sensory and mental. And we can also divide them even further into six divisions according to which sense power they depend on. Depending on the eye sense power, then it would be eye consciousness. And then depending on the ear power, ear consciousness, the nose consciousness, and tongue, body, and mental. So that's like we've looked at before, the six different types of minds. And with the sixth, mental consciousness, that can either be conceptual or non-conceptual. So the first five are always non-conceptual. Sense consciousnesses are always non-conceptual. Mental consciousness could be conceptual or non-conceptual. So what would be... Remember back? An example of a non-conceptual mental consciousness? Mental consciousness that's non-conceptual? Yes? Yogic direct perceiver, realizing emptiness? Or selflessness, or impermanence, or whatever. Yogic direct perceiver. Any others? Clairvoyance, yeah. Huh? Yeah, a self-knower is. Actually, even though we looked at four different types of direct perceivers, sense direct perceivers, mental direct perceivers, yogic direct perceivers, self-knowing direct perceivers, those last three are actually all mental. They're all mental direct perceivers. And then what would be an example of a conceptual mental consciousness? Actually, all of our thoughts, all the zillions of thoughts that we have every day, they are all mostly conceptual. Some of them are wrong, some of them are not wrong, but yeah, we have a lot of conceptual mental consciousnesses. Okay, so those are main minds. So we can say they're, in an elaborate way, six different types of main minds related to our six senses, we could say. Okay, now mental factors. This is more complicated. And I thought to throw in here, make it even more complicated, but it's useful to know, you know, that there are different traditions and they do enumerate the mental factors in different ways. So I got this from, because I was wondering about the Theravada tradition, you know, they do have a different explanation. So I got this from Wikipedia. You can look it up too if you want to know more detail. You know what I of information on there. So in Theravada Abhidharma, they have 52 mental factors in these groups, 7 universal, 6 occasional, 14 unwholesome, and 25 beautiful. That's a nice term, isn't it? I read it once. There's this book by Daniel Goldman. I can't remember exactly the name of it. It was written a long time ago, but he's kind of exploring meditation in different traditions, not just Buddhism, but Christianity, Judaism, and so on. And in that book, he goes through these mental factors, but you can also find it in Wikipedia. What are the beautiful mental factors? But anyway, those are the positive ones, the virtuous ones, the wholesome ones. And then in Abhidharma Kosha by Vasubandhu, and this is representing the Vaibhashika school, there are 46 mental factors. I wanted to check this as well because last time I talked, I said there were only 10 virtuous mental factors, and I wasn't sure if I got that wrong. So it is correct according to his system. There's 10 omnipresent mental factors. That means with every single moment of mind, there are 10. And then 10 virtuous ones, 2 non-virtuous, 6 great afflictions, 10 small afflictions, and 8 indefinite. So 46 altogether. We don't need to go into all those details. Okay, the next is Sotrantika school. So that's the system that we normally follow, and there are 51 mental factors, and it says in Mind in Tibetan Buddhism that this system is accepted also by Chittamatra and Madhyamika. So there are 5 omnipresent, 5 object ascertaining, 11 virtuous, 6 root unwholesome, 20 secondary or auxiliary unwholesome, and 4 changeable. Okay, so if you want to know more details, you can look it up on Wikipedia. Mental factors, Buddhism. And the article also says, because this is something people wonder sometimes, is that all the mental factors there are? There's no more than those? And that's not the case. So these lists of mental factors are not considered to be exhaustive. Rather, they represent significant categories and mental factors that are useful to study in order to understand how the mind functions. And the Dalai Lama has said, whether the system includes 51 mental factors or more or less, none of those sets is meant to be all-inclusive, as though nothing is left out. They are only suggestive, indicative of some things that are important. So there are other mental factors besides the ones on these lists. So I always wondered about fear. There's no mention of fear. Mm-hmm. Fear is a pretty important state of mind. It's there a lot, right? But it's not mentioned in any of these mental factors. So it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Obviously it does. But I think these lists are the ones that we need to know about in order to work on our mind, in order to practice meditation, free our minds from the causes of suffering, develop the causes of happiness, progress along the path, and eventually reach liberation and enlightenment. So that's why these lists were put together.
Because this list of 51 is supposed to be ones that are very important, it seems like fear would be listed, and it would be changeable because we're told that we need to learn to have, we need to develop fear of the lower realms in a healthy way, but not to have panicky, more afflicted fear. And so that would make it a changeable one, I would think, or indefinite is the term, mm-hmm. another term.
Yeah.
Seems really odd that they left that one out.
I don't know why. Don't ask me why. There's actually a book by Geshe Tashi Tsering from London who put together this course called Foundation of Buddhist Thought. It has 6 different modules, and there's 6 books related to each one. So one of those is called Buddhist Psychology. And he offers other suggested lists of mental factors. Because often in the West, too, Western people say, well, what about depression? And what about, you know, anxiety? And what about all these other things that we experience? They're not on there. So he's kind of expanded the list. If you're interested, you could have a look on there. I think he probably includes fear somewhere in there. But I've tried looking at his explanation. I found it a bit complicated. But, yeah, anyway. Definitely fear exists. And I agree with you that it could be positive or it could be negative depending on the context and how what we do with it, and the Dalai Lama as well. He says, you know, fear in itself isn't bad, sometimes useful, but if we get stuck in it or if it's unreasonable, like, you know, people can be afraid when there's really nothing to be afraid of. So sometimes it's like that. Anyway, so let's start looking at the list of the 51 mental factors according to Sutrantika. And I took this from Venerable's book, the second volume of the Library of Wisdom and Compassion. It's Foundation of Buddhist Practice. So in that book, there's a list of most of the mental factors. So we'll just go through these and see how many we can do. We can carry on another time. So we'll start, they usually start with the five omnipresent mental factors. So they're called that because they are there all the time with every single moment of mind, every eye consciousness, every ear consciousness, every blah, 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 mental consciousness, every thought, even yogic direct perceivers. I think, as far as I know, even Buddha's mind would still have these five. I think so. I've never heard otherwise. They're always there with every single mind. It says, without them, complete cognition of an object cannot occur. And in themselves, they're neither virtuous nor non-virtuous, but they could become virtuous or non-virtuous depending on if another mental factor, like if a non-virtuous mental factor is also there, then they would become virtuous or non-virtuous, you know, according to the quality of that one. So the first one is feeling. So feeling is an experience of pleasure, pain, or neutrality. Feeling, yeah. So what this means is pleasure and pain are not objects, but subjects. Okay, it's not that pain is an object and we experience that, or pleasure is an object that we experience, but it's the subject itself, it's the mind itself. Pain or pleasure is... Yeah, it's quite amazing, isn't it? there is an object. Okay, there is an object. The mind is experiencing an object, but that object itself isn't pain or pleasure. Rather, it's a subjective way of experiencing that object. Yeah, for me that was kind of a revelation, because I used to think, there's this pain in my body, but actually it's not like that. It's the mind. The mind is, there's something going on in the body, but it's the mind that's experiencing that as painful. But that kind of helps understand this other amazing thing they say when, an Arya Bodhisattva. Narya Bodhisattva means a bodhisattva who has direct realization of emptiness. So an Arya Bodhisattva doesn't experience any more pain, even if their body is cut into pieces. You know, you hear about these stories about somebody cutting up a bodhisattva into pieces, and the bodhisattva doesn't experience any unhappiness. But they also don't experience any pain. Everything they experience is pleasurable. So that shows, you know, if we have our body cut, we experience pain. Bodhisattva doesn't. What's going on? Sorry. Don't laugh too hard. It probably makes it hurt more. Yeah. But then that explains it, right? How a bodhisattva can actually experience bliss. That's what it said. They feel bliss. They feel pleasure rather than pain, even when their body is cut or burned or something like that. And it's the power of their mind. Because their mind is so pure and so developed, and this realization of emptiness. It's not just the realization of emptiness, but it's conjoined with bodhicitta. Because that doesn't happen with hearers and solitary realizers. Yeah. When they have a direct realization of emptiness, they still have pain. So it's because they don't have this great compassion and bodhicitta. But anyway, so it's quite interesting. And it said that feeling experiences the results of our past actions. Feeling is the ripening of our karma. So that's why we experience pain, because we're experiencing the result of bad karma we created in the past. And a bodhisattva, even if they're being cut or burned or whatever, don't experience pain. It's because of the immense virtue that they have created and the almost zero negative karma left. So that's quite amazing. And feeling is a very important mental factor, because if we're not careful, if we're not mindful, it can lead to afflictive emotions. When we have a pleasant feeling, then it's very easy for that to turn into, or not turn into, but lead to attachment, desire. I want that. I want more. I want to keep it. I want to own it. Yeah? And when we have a painful feeling, that can lead to anger, aversion, hatred, aggression, violence, right? That's easy to see, right? When we're in pain. We want to hurt somebody, do something destructive. So this is the case with most sentient beings, especially they have no knowledge of Dharma, no knowledge of how the mind works, how karma works, and so on. So they're just acting, automatically. Feel good, I want more of that. Grasping, desire, attachment, addiction. I feel bad, get that away from me. Even if it means killing somebody. So as meditators, those of us wanting to follow the path, we need to watch our mind. That's one of the main the four foundations of mindfulness. The second of those is mindfulness of feelings. That's a really, really, really important thing, to be mindful of our feelings. And why we need, or how we need to be mindful of our feelings, is just to be careful. I mean, we can't help but have pleasant feelings and unpleasant feelings. We can't stop that. That's just going to keep happening. But we can at least do our best to not let pleasant feelings get us into desire and attachment and craving. And even if those do arise, try to apply antidotes as soon as possible. And then with unpleasant feelings, really try to be careful that those don't lead into anger and hatred and aggressiveness and so on and so forth. Or even if those states of mind do arise, apply antidotes to them. So that's why, feeling is a very, very important mental factor. It can lead to so much suffering if we're not careful, but it can also lead to happiness and peace and eventually enlightenment if we know how to work with them.
I just wanted to share that feelings really convinces me of karma, especially mental feelings, because I'll just be going about my day or sitting somewhere, and all of a sudden this mental feeling will come over me, happiness, sadness, whatever, and it seems to be totally unconnected with whatever is going on. And then similar situations, one day I'll have a completely different reaction than the previous day, and sometimes I apply antidotes and they work, other times I apply them and they don't work. So it's like, yeah, it really convinces me that something is going on here that, you know, is caused by things in the past, way in the past.
Yeah, and wasn't it last week we were talking about food? Venerable Jampa brought up this experience of, you know, having to eat certain types of food that you just naturally felt this aversion towards. And so that would be, I think, related to this. When you, you know, that kind of food is there on your plate, looking at it or smelling it or tasting it, and an unpleasant feeling arises. I mean, for some people, a pleasant feeling arises. Yeah, they're really happy, delighted to eat that food. But for us, it's like, ugh. So why is that? So it's because of karma. Because of our karma from the past is ripening in the form of this pleasant feeling or unpleasant feeling. And the same with everything else. People that we see, sounds that we hear, you know, people like different kinds of music. For you know, the music that some people love, other people can't stand, and vice versa. Smells, tastes, physical sensations. Some people love it when it's, you know, freezing cold, and other people are suffering, and vice versa. You know, so I was in Australia once, and I met this guy who was working in a place where it would get to be, I don't know, 60 degrees Celsius. What is that, Fahrenheit? That's like 130, 140. Yeah, off the charts. And he said, I love it. Whoa. So, yeah. Well, it could also be physiology. I mean, people's physical bodies are different as well. But yeah, it just shows why do we, different people have pleasant feelings for different things or unpleasant feelings for different things. So, at least one of the explanations is our karma.
And then about, do sense consciousnesses have afflictions? I was thinking back to one division of mind is into sense consciousnesses and mental consciousness. And that division is a little bit arbitrary. I don't know if you'd say it like that, but it was invented in order to help study the mind, better understand the mind. But in actuality, they're kind of unified, aren't they?
Well, the main difference between them is the faculty. Sometimes they use the word faculty or sense power or sense organ. Okay, so like having an eye consciousness, being able to, or what we call see, okay, being able to see an object, that depends on having a properly functioning eye sense power. Okay, so if your eye sense power isn't working or your eyes are closed or something, then you cannot have visual consciousness. Visual consciousness just doesn't happen. Okay, and eye consciousness knows certain types of objects, colors and shapes. Our ear consciousness doesn't know colors and shapes. Our nose consciousness doesn't know colors and shapes and so on, right? I mean, they say with the Buddha, every consciousness of a Buddha can see every type of object. So for a Buddha, that's not a problem. But for us, ordinary beings, we need these six different types of consciousnesses to be able to know different kinds of objects. Our eye consciousness, colors and shapes. Our ear consciousness, sounds. We can't see sounds with our eyes or smell them. You know, we can't smell sounds with our nose. So it's not really arbitrary or just somebody's invention, but we do have these six different ways of knowing six different kinds of objects. That makes sense? Yeah, and they are dependent on the sense power. Because right? Yeah. If you don't have, for example, in the form realm, and you know, after attaining concentration, super high concentration, they say the beings in the form realm only have three types of physical senses: seeing, hearing, and bodily consciousness. They don't have sense of smell, don't have sense of taste. They don't need to eat. So there are different kinds of objects that are experienced by different kinds of consciousnesses.
Yeah, I'm just thrown by the Buddha being able to experience everything. All the consciousnesses can experience the objects of the other consciousnesses. So it is possible for the mind to become unified in a sense.
Yeah, and I've also heard, has anyone heard this, that there are also some cases of people who can see sounds, or I don't know how it works, I can't remember how it is, but something.
She I don't know, I think she had been, she was quite an adult before she realized that all people didn't see, like, colors and a pitch are the same. Something like that, you know, that they don't, you know, or also there's something about numbers and colors, I think, that she does, mm-hmm. that they relate in a certain kind of way. It just appears to her mind in that way.
Mm. Yeah, so it looks like some people have the ability to see objects that are, you know, with certain senses that are normally seen by or experienced by other senses. I've heard of that.
It seems like they're associating one with the other. They're not necessarily seeing colors with their ears, but they hear certain pitches and they associate a certain color with it.
I don't know.
I don't know if they're actually one sense consciousness seeing the other.
I don't know. We have to look into that, investigate that more carefully.
And solitary realizers still have negative feelings arise, but they don't have any afflictions that follow on from that. And it's just, because you said that hearers and solitary, unlike bodhisattvas who don't have any negative feelings arise, hearers and solitary realizes.
I didn't say negative, painful feelings. The feeling of pain.
Okay. In terms of the three types of feelings, that would be a negative or unpleasant feeling.
I don't know if negative is the right word. Painful. Painful feeling, unpleasant feeling.
Okay. But no affliction arises in relation to it?
Well, it depends on where they're at. I mean, if they're an Arya, if they've directly realized emptiness, I'm not sure if they would, because they haven't totally eliminated all the afflictions. They've eliminated the intellectually acquired afflictions, but not the innate afflictions. But they're probably very heavily subdued, so I don't know if they would be kind of jumping up in the mind when they have. Yeah, probably not. They're not abandoned. They're not totally abandoned or eliminated, but they're probably also not coming up in their mind the way they do in our minds. But no, but it's the same with bodhisattvas. I mean, Arya bodhisattva, first ground bodhisattva, hasn't completely eliminated all their afflictive emotions. They don't do that until the eighth ground. But the point I made was they don't have physical pain. They don't have any more physical pain. Now, I don't know if with the other five senses, if they would not have any unpleasant feeling. I'm not sure about that. It's mainly spoken about with regard to the tactile, the bodily feelings. Because, you know, you hear these stories about bodhisattvas just giving away their body here and there. And it seems that they don't feel pain when they do this. But whether they would be free of pain, painful feeling with eye consciousness, with ear consciousness, I don't know. I haven't heard that. But probably not, because they don't experience suffering, coarse suffering, you know, like suffering of suffering. They don't have that anymore. Even though they may manifest, they say, they may show the manifestation of being sick, dying, and so forth, if they're with us in this world. But they say this is more an appearance, but they don't actually have those, like, eight types of suffering. And it's mainly because of the power of their great compassion and their bodhicitta. So let's see if we can get through this list of five for tonight. Okay, so number two is discrimination. This is also a very important mental factor. Its function is to distinguish it is this and not that, and to apprehend the characteristics of an object. It differentiates and identifies objects. So it's able to tell one thing from another. And again, it accompanies even sense perception, seeing, hearing, smelling, and so forth, which are non-conceptual. Okay, so when we see an object, we're not thinking about it. We're just having this raw, direct experience of an object. But with that seeing of the object, there is this mental factor of discrimination that knows the differences between that object and another one. Okay, so colors, for example. Our eye consciousness does know red from blue, even though it doesn't say that is red and that is blue, but it just knows those are different objects. They have certain characteristics that are unique to that object, and the discrimination is able to recognize those. And then later, the conceptual mind, not later can mean just a few moments later, conceptual mind kicks in and gives it a name, red, blue. But like a baby, for example, baby doesn't yet know the names for colors, but is still able to identify different colors and also different people. That's mommy, that's daddy, even before they've learned the words for mommy and daddy and dog and cat and so on and so forth. So they can recognize things. So that's because of discrimination, this mental factor. But of course, it can be much more complex than that. So when we get into school, university, and so forth, then discrimination is able to get really, you know, and fine-tuned in knowing this kind of bacteria from that kind of bacteria and so forth. So it can be trained to recognize even more things. So that's another of the ever-present, omnipresent mental factors. Okay, number three is also very important. They're all important. Number three is intention. And this has the function of moving the mind, both the main mind and all the other mental factors accompanying it, to the object, directing, focusing the mind on the object. It is the conscious and automatic motivating element that causes the mind to involve itself with and apprehend its object. And it is karma. Okay, so this is what karma is. Karma is this mental factor of intention. Although the mental factor of intention itself is not constructive, destructive, or neutral, it becomes so depending on what other mental factors like attachment or anger accompany it. Okay. So in itself, it's kind of neutral. But if it's together with attachment, if we're looking at an object with attachment, we see this attractive object in a department store, the window or whatever, TV, we see this really attractive object, and attachment comes up, so then it becomes non-virtuous or destructive. The word destructive is a bit strong, isn't it? Yeah. I guess it depends on what you mean by destructive. But usually it's non-virtuous. We say non-virtuous. So if there's attachment or anger or one of the other disturbing mental states, then the karma becomes non-virtuous. But if it's something positive, if we were looking at an image of the Buddha, for example, with faith, with devotion, with respect, seeing wonderful qualities, wanting to emulate them, then that's a virtuous state of mind. So then the intention and that whole mind and all the mental factors with it will become virtuous. Then number four is attention. And this also is said to direct the primary mind and its mental factors to the object and to apprehend the object. So then what's the difference between intention and attention. They seem quite similar. So in the text of Geshe Gelson, the Minds and Mental Factors text, he says, intention, number three, moves the mind to objects in general, like a general feel of reverence. And attention will direct the mind to more specific objects within that field. So, for example, attention, like if we're looking out the window at the garden, okay, so we're just looking at the garden in general, that would be intention. And then if our mind focuses on a specific thing, like we see a bird or a flower, so focusing on a specific object would be attention, number four. So they both direct the mind to objects, but the first one is in a more general way, the second one is more specific. And number four, attention, also says it focuses and holds the mind on an object without allowing it to move elsewhere. So that's what we say in English, right? Pay attention. Pay attention. Don't let your mind wander. Be attentive.
So could you say, let's say I have the intention to be very compassionate within this community, that would be my intention, is more an overall thing. And my attention would be in everyday life. Let's say the person was right in front of me would be the object of my compassion. So I'm very attentive. Can you break that down like that?
Sounds good. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we do use the word intention. Like, what is your intention here? Yeah, as like a motivation, like I'm synonymous with motivation. But I think intention and motivation are not exactly the same. Because if you look at the explanation of what intention is, it's not really the same as motivation. Right? It's more like focusing on an object, directing to an object. Motivation, when we talk about motivation, it's more like, why am I doing it? Why am I doing this action? You know, do I want to help this person? Do I want to harm this person? Do I want to get something out of this person? So it's more about quite the same. So what you said about wanting to benefit this community, I'm not sure if that's really intention as it's explained here or motivation. Motivation. So then, with that as your motivation, like we wake up every morning and train ourselves to generate a motivation for the day. I want to benefit others as much as I can. I want to avoid harming them as much as possible. And I want to direct everything that I do for enlightenment. Okay, so that's what we're advised to do. That's what we try to do. That's our motivation for all our actions. But I'm not sure if intention would be the same. But maybe with that as the motivation, the underlying motivation, then when we do focus on, for example, going to the meditation hall at 5:15 or whatever in the morning, yeah, so we're focusing on that and going to that and then doing the practices, the prayers and so forth. I mean, definitely intention is there. It's an ever-present mental factor. It's there every single moment, focusing our mind on objects. But I don't know if it's exactly the same as motivation, what we call motivation. Motivation seems to be more complex.
Well, our prayers in the morning may not harm any sentient being. That's an intention. It's not a motivation.
Yeah, it is an intention in English, the way we use the word in English. But if you look at the way it's described as the mental factor of intention, it's just moving the mind to an object. I'm not sure. I have to admit, I've never fully understood this one, what this mental factor is about and how it is karma. but something to be explored further. But yeah, it's quite amazing when we think about it every moment, with not just every moment, but with every single mental state, which there's many every moment, you know. Every single moment there's an intention moving the mind to an object. And an object doesn't necessarily mean things around us, outside of us. They can also be inner objects. Memories of things from the past or thoughts about things in the future. So every single moment, you know, our mind is going to some object. And it's this mental factor that's responsible for that, that's drawing the mind or pushing the mind to the object. It's quite awesome when you think about it.
Do you know about the sequence of these? Like, so contact is the cause of feeling. It says that right here. Mm. Contact has to be cause of the next moment of feeling. Mm. But it also sounds the same thing with intention and attention might be going on too, that intention draws the mind and attention of the next moment is... So it just makes... I mean, is this kind of...
They're simultaneous. There is an intention and an
Yes, they're simultaneous.
Intention and attention at the same time.
Yes, they're simultaneous.
Yeah.
But can they be on the same object at the same time? And is this part of the train that drives the one moment of mind that follows the next, I wonder?
I don't know. I mean, when I try to think about these kind of things, it's like just too mind-boggling. Especially when you think this is happening 65 times every second, every time, every finger snap, or billions with, according to the Theravada tradition, billions of times every moment this is happening. It's really... Yeah, beyond my ability to grasp and understand, and of course to be able to recognize it happening is.
According to the five similarities, they have to be on the same object at the same time.
Yeah, the intention and the attention that are together with one main mind would have to be on the same object, but still the intention might be focused more on the object in general and the attention maybe more specific details of it.
By definition, if contact is the cause of feeling, they cannot be simultaneous.
No, contact is a cause of feeling, but it's the cause of the feeling that arises the next moment. So the feeling of moment A would be the result of the contact of the previous moment. Because, you know, our mind isn't really jumping from one object to another 65 times a finger snap. But, you know, there'll be several moments, several successive moments of focusing on the same object. Okay, so in the first moment, you have contact. The next moment, you have the feeling of that. I mean, this is how it's explained, but, you know... Who's actually able to take an Arya to actually be able to watch this process and be fully aware of each and every experience that's happening every moment and their connections with each other? But yeah, number five, just to finish these five, number five is contact. And contact is a mental factor that connects the three things needed for an experience to take place. The object, and then here it says cognitive faculty, meaning the sense power, like the eye sense power, and the primary consciousness, the consciousness that was there just before. So connecting those three to be able to have the experience of pleasure, pain, and indifference. It's the cause of feeling. In Geshe Rabten's book, it says that contact activates the sense power. Okay, so we have this eye sense power in there. So contact activates it so that the sense power becomes able to be the basis for feeling. I mean, my understanding is this came from the Buddha's experience. The Buddha, when he was meditating and spending all those years, 24 hours a day, just watching his mind and getting deeper and deeper and clearer about what's going on. So he recognized you know, this process and explained it according to his experience. So to actually understand it, maybe, you know, you have to be quite highly evolved and also have super concentration, super mindfulness to be able to recognize what's going on. So that's as much as I know. That's as much as I can explain. And just laying some seeds for the future.
Someone online looked up synesthesia for us and said that from Psychology Today, that synesthesia is a neurological condition in which stimulation of one sensory or cognitive pathway, for example, hearing, leads to the automatic, involuntary experience in a second sensory or cognitive pathway, such as vision. So you have one sense power activated, and automatically it activates another one, so you're having automatic, involuntary experience in that other sense power. Or sense consciousness.
Yeah, because I think according to science, there's different parts of the brain responsible for different sensory experiences, seeing, hearing, and so forth. So I'm not sure how that connects with the Buddhist explanation. if there is a connection or if it's just totally different. Yeah, so it's probably easier to explain that phenomenon with the brain rather than with the Buddhist explanation of the mind. I don't know. Like I say, I don't know everything. I don't understand everything. So, okay. So we'll stop there and dedicate. And then maybe sometime later we'll be able to carry on looking at the other mental factors.